Beach Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich at WBAI, sitting in for Shannon Young. Leon Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jay Paget-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org, www.fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Volado.
Listening to 90.9 and 104.1 on your FM dial, WMPG, Greater Portland Community Radio. We have got a lot going on tonight. It's 7:30. It's a public affairs block. We have Sound Ecology with host Karen DeAndre coming right up. On Thursday, March 30th, USM School of Music presents the DePonte String Quartet at 7 p.m. For more information, call 529-4555.
In a radio station, bomb bomb. The truth shall come. Keep the corporations of complication, bomb bomb. Rock the nation. Take over television and radio station, bomb bomb. The truth shall come. Keep the corporations of complication.
That's right. It's Sound Ecology time. As I had told you before, we're just relaxing here. We have a good show upcoming about dams and rivers and eels, and there's a fascinating, I don't know what you call a mannequin of an eel, or a stuffed eel, or a, whatever it is. It's a very threatening looking fish sitting in the other room through the window.
Sorry.
What's going on in there?
I'm like wandering around.
I noticed. I had to talk about this eel I don't know very much about.
Yeah, it's an American eel.
Is it?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Handsome.
I'm not kidding you about that.
It's a nice looking
It's not European. It's not Asian. It's not none of that stuff. It's downright, you know,
indigenous.
Red-blooded, cold-blooded,
Sebastocook
American eel.
Copsaconti steamish or something?
Sebastocook.
Sebastocook, that's where he's from.
It's a native eel. Yeah. Although they do some traveling, and we're going to be talking about eels here shortly.
Yeah, this one's been down to Lyman back, and that's where it got to look so nice again.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So it's really gotten around. All right, so we know now eels get around.
So do we know when we're on the air here?
We are on the air.
Cool, okay.
We're on the air, signals going out, things are recording, people are excited.
It's just an incredible thing. It's FM, it's freaking magic.
It's freaking magic. Well, it's probably the first eel on the radio.
Yeah, well, we've had a solid owl here before, a couple of dogs, a wolf, and now an eel. You know, you just never know what might pop up in the studio with WMPG. So, as Bill said, I am Karen DeAndre, your host for Sound Ecology. Thank you, William.
Thank you, Karen, for this wonderful opportunity. I forgot your guest names already, so why don't you just stem and get to some news and notes? And
yeah, I got to get to these announcements, too. Yeah, we're going to get on with the show here shortly. Of course, as everyone already knows, we're going to be talking about eels. They're slippery, and they're dammed in Maine. So we're going to be talking about them shortly. let me get to these announcements really quick. After a third case of mad cow disease having been confirmed in the U.S. in a downed cow, Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, New York, has reissued a call for a full and permanent ban on downed animals entering the food supply. 78 confirmed cases of mad cow disease, that's bovine spongiform encephalopathy, I think I got that right, BSE, confirmed in North America were in downed animals. Farm Sanctuary is urging the USDA to make permanent its temporary ban on slaughtering downed cattle for human food and is supporting the passage of federal legislation to ban the marketing and slaughter of downed animals. In addition to BSE, downed animals are more likely to be contaminated with fecal pathogens. I'm just going to say that again. Fecal pathogens. So everybody who eats meat, I just want you to know you're eating fecal pathogens, all right, and other diseases. And it's impossible to move them humanely. And Gene Boston, president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary, an organization that has worked to end the marketing of downed animals since its inception 20 years ago. In addition, additional information about Farm Sanctuary's campaign to permanently end the marketing of downer cattle can be found at www.nodowners.org, or check out their other website, farmsanctuary.org. Coming up Monday, March the 20th, 7 p.m., USM Luther Bonney Auditorium, Lifting as We Climb, civil rights pioneer Judge Constance Baker Motley, keynote speaker E. Christine Cunningham, professor of law at Howard University School of Law. Professor Cunningham clerked for the United States District Court. Judge Constance Baker Motley of the Southern District in New York. Judge Baker Motley passed away last fall after a long and distinguished career as a civil rights attorney and judge. As an attorney, represented Martin Luther King Jr. and was the only woman on the Brown versus Board of Education legal team. She won 9 out of 10 of her arguments before the United States Supreme Court and distinguished herself as the first black woman in very many ways. This event is free and open to the public. For more information, please contact the Office of Multicultural Student Affairs, 780-4006, 780-4006. You are invited to a party at CTN Channel 4 on Friday, March the 31st, between 3 p.m. and midnight at 516 Congress Street in Portland. Also, performers are needed to kick off the 20th anniversary celebration. So calling all acoustic performers for CTN's 20th anniversary party for our local public television stations, Channels 2, 3, and 4. We have been bringing you great local programming for 20 years, and now we want you to help us celebrate this milestone. Join us in celebrating Greater Portland's community television stations. Come down for food, fun, friends, and song. Party all night long. We can't do it without you. Contact Bill Blood, station engineer at CTN, at 775-2900, extension 12. Thursday, March 16th, a panel discussion, that's tomorrow night, with Iraqi veterans and others on current violence in the region at 7 p.m. at the Moot Courtroom at the USM Law School. I'll be attending this. I think this is going to be great. If folks listened to the show last week, we had on Dexter Kamilevich, whose son Ben is currently over in Iraq, and he will be one of the panelists tomorrow night. Stop by for that. I think it's going to be a really interesting evening. Again, 7 p.m. at the Moot Courtroom at the USM Law School. For more information, you can call John Bauer, 780-4490, 780-4490. Friday, March the 17th, Summit Against Waste in Maine, with workshops, music, theater, and speaker Lois Gibbs from Love Canal all day long at the UU Church in Augusta. For more information, contact Will Everett with Toxics Action Org, or Hillary, 649-5980, 649-5980. Saturday, March the 18th, Sustainable Maine, Turning Toward Peace Through Jobs and a Clean Environment, conference with workshops on many issues all day at UMaine Farmington. For more information, contact Jessica Eller at Peace Action Maine, 772-0680, 772-0680. Saturday, March the 18th, the third annual Chain of Concern to Oppose Continued U.S. Occupation of Iraq, 11 a.m. till noon at State Street across from Eastern Maine Medical Center in Bangor. For more information, contact the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine, 942-9343, 942-9343. Saturday, March the 18th, yes, it's the Equality Maine Annual Awards Banquet. This thing is huge, by the way. If anybody's ever attended this, I'm going for my first time this year. There's going to be like hundreds of people at this thing. It's massive. Anyway, it's going to be really fun. And if you'd like to go, you better call them now, 761-3732, because they may be full or pretty darn close. 761-3732. It is at the Holiday Inn Back Bay. It's a great thing. For more information, you can also check out their website, equalitymaine.org. Saturday, March the 18th through the 26th, the Maine Jewish Film Festival. Also a great thing going on this weekend. Showings of over 20 films, movies, and other other locations in Portland. For more information, you can give them a call at 831-7495, 831-7495, or check out their website, mjff.org. I attended, I don't know, it was a couple of years ago, and it's just, it's fabulous. I can't say enough about that. Sunday, March the 19th, third anniversary of the beginning of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, with local actions in Maine on that day and before. There is a, I'm trying to think now, the Bridges for Peace. So here in Portland, Bridges for Peace is having their action or their protest on the bridge, south side, going toward the north side, starting at noon, from noon to 2, and I believe there's also folks getting together in Monument Square after that. Again, that's on Sunday, March the 19th. Also coming up Sunday, March the 19th, the last best chance threat of nuclear attacks film shown at 6 p.m. at the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine. For more information, 942-9343. And then Monday, March the 20th, Disability Awareness Day, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Hall of Flags, State Capitol Building in Augusta. For more information, call the Disability Rights Center, 800-452-1948. Again, that's 800-452-1948. And we did it. We made it all the way through the announcements. So, what? Did you have something? You looked like you were grabbing the microphone.
No, I was doing some station work there, and you made it sound like you wanted to talk.
Well, we could. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. How about eels?
Oh, my God, what a great idea. You know, I just happen to have two people in the studio that can talk about that.
And one that wish it could talk.
That's right.
Well, you can't anymore.
The story she could tell.
No glugging through the ocean currents any longer for little Elvira eel. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'll get a little bit more serious. We got two great guests in the studio with us tonight. One who's been here on several occasions over the years. So tonight with us is Ed Friedman. He is the chair for the board of the Friends of Merry Meeting Bay. So we're glad to have you here, Ed.
Nice to be here.
Not to be confused with Kathleen McGee, who is formerly on the board of Friends of Merry Meeting Bay, and she's an environmental activist. She's been really active in a lot of issues around toxics in the environment, and has been on this show, gosh, probably two or three.
Oh, four or five.
Oh, or at least that. So we're glad to have you back,
Thank
Kathleen.
You.
Here to talk about this issue that, you know, I gotta say this, you know, when I first got Ed's email, I thought, eels? I mean, what's the big deal? It's an eel. It's like a tick. Who cares if ticks die, right? It's an eel. They're kind of ugly. They're long. They got some teeth and... It's an eel.
You're in that mode. It's really the sweet, saucy eel.
Unagi.
Sweet, saucy eel is how they often were described by the early settlers in this country, because people in other countries, in particular England in this case, always considered the eel to be prime eating. And again, even today in other cultures, they are not the tick or the gnat or the mosquito or the any sort of affiliation like that, but they are really some of the best eating, very respected. The Indians in this country, Native Americans, always ate quite a few and caught quite a few.
They were likely at the first Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Probably not turkey. It was
no turkeys, just eels.
Well, we certainly have an interesting one here. There, well, it looks like an eel, no doubt about it. This one has to be, what?
About a meter long, or just a little less than a yard, yeah. Yard.
And it has some little teeth in it, as I can see here. And this is a female. The one thing that I found that was pretty interesting about this, and I want to talk a little bit more specifically about their life cycle, but the females tend to be... sort of migrate more into the northern states, whereas the males predominantly will migrate into the southern states. Although there, I guess there's some question about that, but I know that I had read something about that, which I found kind of interesting.
I think of it more as, that may happen to some extent, I think of it a little bit more as they don't have a sex. The sex is not determined when they come into the rivers, and whoever gets to the best habitat tends to become a female. So, and the best habitat usually is further upstream, so that you would find some males typically closer to the ocean, the estuaries, but it's the females who get to the good. The good areas way up.
Right, and there's a word that describes these kinds of fish, and salmon is the same word, and it's, no?
No, well, if
no, it's because they go, because they can go from salt water into fresh water.
Well, that's anadromous fish.
You want to describe?
There are several anadromous fish, especially that come into Friends of Merrimining Bay. Nine?
Or into Merrimining Bay.
Well, you know, we're open to anybody joining.
That's right.
It's a real diverse place.
It's a diverse group, yes.
And they go from salt water to fresh water to spawn, and then it can go back. Eels, it's the opposite. So it's... Now I'm going to not say this right.
It's
they're catadromous.
I knew it was cat or something.
My tongue wouldn't work.
Right.
Catadromous. Yeah. And they actually grow in fresh water and then go to salt water to spawn.
It's really interesting. So, well, let's talk about that, because I think it's probably good that we get our start discussing the issues with them by learning a little bit about their life cycles.
Yep. Eels, American eel, Anguilla rostrata, all are born in the Sargasso Sea, which is a section of the Southwest Atlantic east of Bermuda. It's a pretty large area. No one's ever seen an eel reproduce. No one's ever been able to get an eel to reproduce in captivity.
Really?
The only thing they know is that they've traced larval eels, and they've only figured out after about 40 or 80 years, some large amount of time, that the larvae were actually eels back to that area. And that's, they get to a certain size, and that's all they know. Those larval eels are most often described as looking like a willow leaf. They're like a little piece of ribbon. They're not very long. And they drift with the currents from that central breeding, spawning, birthing area in Sargasso out with the currents. And they come up the east coast, Gulf Stream, and they go up as far as the southern tip of Greenland. And they go down around the Gulf Coast as well. It takes about a year to do that. Over that time, they metamorphose into what we call a glass eel, what we think of as a typical eel shape, little finger type.
And you can see through them. They're
you can
really
see through
so
them.
Cool.
They're transparent.
They really
point.
Are. They are cute at that. They're not cute at this stage.
Yes.
They're cute at that little stage.
Yeah, and actually, one of those pictures I brought in had a picture of one in somebody's hand. See a little black eye. So they're about a year old when they hit the streams, and then they spend maybe a couple of years as what they tend to call, they go from glass eels to elvers when they start to pigment a little bit, and then they sort of go to being yellow eels for a few years, they call them that, as they start to migrate up the river.
And I know what the next, is the next one silver?
Well, silvers are what they call them when they're ready to out-migrate to spawn, and eels only spawn once in their life, and they can be anywhere from...
That's when they become black belts. They go from...
from yellow, from yellow belts to silver belts or bronze belts. This one here happens to be kind of bronzy, but she would transition to being more silvery in color. I've also heard that their color can change depending on the bottom and the habitat that they're in. But in any case, they only spawn once in their life, and that might be anywhere from 10 to 50 years old. And they tend to get longer, larger, and older the further north they get. So we'll talk about toxics a little bit later and some of the eel kills on the Sebasticook, but eels that we picked up there were in a similar range to this specimen we have here. It's a beautiful mount. It was your partner was asking how it got to be this way. It was original eel and was mounted. It was skinned and it was mounted, done by Creative Maine Taxidermy down in Lyman, Maine. And we did age the eels that we sampled for toxins, and we found eels in this size range to all be about 23 years old.
Okay. first, let me give out the phone number here. 780-4909, 780-4909. We've got about 12 minutes till the top of the hour, so there's plenty of time to call in if you're just as confused about Eagles as I am. So what you're trying to tell me is that they hatch. They drift along the currents, do-to-do-to-do. Yep. They travel up the states. They go hang out. Now, are they hanging out there for this length of time so they don't then...
They don't move a long way.
They pretty much stay in the fresh water once they drift up from the Sargasso Sea, and they can be up here for...
I think as much as 40, 50 years.
But and they never breed during that.
They never breed.
And that's what's so important about this is they have one shot. And they can be as old as 50 years old, and they can have as many as 6 million eggs in them. And in the process of trying to get back to the Sargasso Sea for the one and only time they breed, the one and only time, sometimes 50 years, we kill them at a very, very high rate through the turbines of dams. So that's what one of the things that makes this so important is they only have one shot.
Yeah. So one of the key issues that we're talking about here are the effect of dams on eels, and they act in two ways primarily. Once, as they are young eels trying to get upstream, the dams act as barriers to migration. And so imagine all those little elvers kind of...
Because they're little. They're only like a couple of inches long.
And they're really cool because they can actually get out of the water and they can climb up the face of a dam. They can go up over rocks. They can go onto grass if it's wet for a short time. But the dams still pose a barrier, and so they tend to congregate. They are looking for a place to get a way to get around. They are then more prone to predation. They get tired out. Some of them never make it. There's often too much water going over a dam that they can get up over that. So that's the first problem. Those that do manage to get up around, when the time comes to migrate out, then have to come back down through those barriers. And if those are hydroelectric dams, and the only way through them is through the turbine blades, they get chopped up. And we're looking at mortality ranges easily up to 100%, 60 to 100%, let's say. And that's just per dam. And if you imagine any of our rivers, like the Androscoggin River, that has no safe eel passage provided, which is doable, around any of their dams, there's a dozen dams on the river. So you can just imagine who's left by the time you run that gauntlet of dams. You know, the very few eels are successfully making it out of the rivers on their spawning run.
So there's... I want to just sort of get this straight about the whole biology of this, because I think that's probably important. So we never, so there's never sort of just mass migrations of these guys. They kind of come and go on their own? Or is there sort of, I mean, because if they come up and some of them hang for 10 years and some of them hang for 20 and some of them hang for 40, how do they, I mean, it's not like the salmon, they all come rushing at once.
Right.
These guys don't all do a rush at once.
But they still tend to move at a particular time of year, which is the fall, and sort of mid-September through November, and they tend to move at night. There are exceptions to that. So they do come through sometimes in slugs of eels. Sometimes there's a bunch of them come through. And they are doing some research with using acoustics underwater to try and monitor when eels might be coming, and then they could possibly shut a turbine down, for example. But right now, eels need an alternative way to get through a dam, and or have the turbines be blocked by a plate with holes in it, or have the turbine shut down. That's what we need when we talk about safe passage. We need an alternative way around, and we need a blockage or shutdown of the turbines. And not one dam on the Androscoggin River provides for safe eel passage.
780-4909, 780-4909 is our number. About 5 minutes before we take our break here at the top of the hour. Again, we're speaking with Kathleen McGee and Ed Friedman from Friends of Merrymeeting Bay, and we're talking about eels, American eels specifically, and the dangers that they face because they're being dammed by dams.
Who gives a damn about eels? why should people?
Well, I mean, I got that email, and I had to think twice about it. I'm like, eels, all right. What is there to really care about? They're not particularly good-looking. They're not warm and fuzzy.
That's the problem. They're not koala bears.
They're not baby seals.
And they're
being clubbed, So I guess it must be pretty hard to sell, let's say, baby eels.
Well, what's happening is they're actually they may be on their way to extinction. And some colleagues of ours, Douglas Watts and his brother Tim, last year filed a petition to list the species as an endangered species. As I mentioned before, they used to go, a few of them still might get as far as southern Greenland, but what we're seeing evidence of is because they start at this epicenter down in the Atlantic, we are seeing the radius of that range essentially drop back. 10 years ago, the St. Lawrence River in Canada and Lake Ontario had the largest eel biomass of any place in the world. They're virtually extinct now. And so we're seeing trends like that. We're seeing drops in eel catches. So we're shrinking back from the outside of that circle back towards the Sargasso. And this is why we need to do something about it. And why eels? They are an extremely important food species for all kinds of our fish and birds that are out there, kind of like the alewives are at the sort of the bottom of the anadromous food chain there. They provide a major food source for all sorts of larger species. Eels do the same thing when they're young. When they get older, they become a fairly top of the food chain predator.
Well, this one's, I can see it chasing down something.
Yeah. So,
it's pretty large.
And in our looking at this issue, we found something really interesting that, in fact, they may play a very valuable role for us, aside from being food, and there's always been a history of very major commercial eel fisheries in the state and in any coastal state, that they may be cleaning our rivers for us. Of toxins, and we can get into that now or later, but we've seen evidence that these guys get very full of toxins, and if uninterrupted, they would be leaving and going off somewhere else. Doesn't say anything good about the toxics in the Sargasso.
Right.
But they're getting toxics out of these confined areas.
Well, before we get into the toxins, I want to just jump back a little bit.
Sure.
You mentioned the commercial eel fisheries. We kind of joked about that a little bit at the beginning about, it is a food source. And it's mostly, I would suspect, an export to other countries. So what do we have commercial eel fishing here in Maine?
Absolutely. And we have very, very small pot fishery left, people using eel pots, like a lobster trap. But we have a few eel weir fishermen, net weirs to catch them. And mostly we have an elver fishery along the coast, so catching the babies when they come in. And as you say, most of those for food are exported. I mentioned that no one has been able to have eels propagate successfully in captivity. So when you go to a Japanese restaurant and you order eel, which is really, really good, that eel probably started as an elver over here. It was shipped to Asia, and it was grown out on an eel farm in Japan and grown to adulthood, or to a large, an edible size, and then harvested. But it was not replaced. It had no opportunity to reproduce. So we're harvesting from the wild end.
So we're burning the candle from both ends.
Yeah.
We're getting the elvers. They're going to Japan, and that's for good or ill. But it's not like, and I'm not a fan of aquaculture, but it's not like aquaculture where you can continue to breed and grow them and breed and grow them and breed. And they're not sexy like salmon either, which are very much sexier than this.
Yeah, they definitely
are. But in some ways it's much more...
Don't get excited.
I'm really sorry, Elvira. You're really not all that. It's true. Well, we are just about here at at the top of the hour, time to take a break and say you are tuned into WMPG W281 AC Gorham Portland. Again, you're also listening to Sound Ecology. We're talking about the American eel and why they're becoming endangered and why they're important to our ecosystems, and we're going to continue that discussion when we come back from this very happy break. Very happy break.
Thank you.
WMPG needs designers, models, and volunteers to help with its second annual fashion show at Space Gallery on Saturday, April 8th. If you design your own clothing, jewelry, or accessories, or if you want to be a model or volunteer at the event, listen up. This year's show opens with Naya's Trance Belly Dance Troupe and features DJs Corbin and Goober from WMPG. If you like to fashion your own duds, and if you'd like to have people see your work on the catwalk, contact us at WMPGFashion@yahoo.com. We need jewelry and accessories too. Handbags, ties, belts, scarves, whatever you have. Just email us at WMPGFashion@yahoo.com. That's WMPGFashion@yahoo.com. Bring it on.
Welcome to Isla Earth. Cell phones are everywhere, and new models with upgraded bells and whistles are being introduced almost daily. Sooner or later, your junk drawer is going to be overflowing with old cell phones, and you may be tempted to dump them in the trash. Don't. Cell phones contain toxic substances such as arsenic, beryllium, lead, nickel, and zinc that can pollute the air when burned in incinerators or leach into soil and drinking water when buried in landfills. These poisons, known as persistent toxins, linger in the environment without breaking down. They accumulate in the tissues of animals and plants and pose a particular threat to young children and the elderly, who are especially vulnerable to poisoning from toxic substances. An organization that can help recycle your phone is Collective Good. Your favorite charity will benefit, and you'll receive a tax credit for donating your phone. Phones are refurbished and sent to a developing country where information technology is a scarce commodity. Learn more by visiting Isla Earth on the web. That's islaearth.org. Isla Earth is funded by the Annenberg Foundation through its Blue Planet Initiative and brought to you by the Catalina Island Conservancy, because Earth is an island.
Take over television and radio station, bomb bomb. The truth shall come, keep the corporations of complication, bomb bomb. Rock the nation, take over television and radio station, bomb bomb. The truth shall come, keep the corporations of complication.
That's right, we have Sound Ecology coming right up. It's WMPG 90.9 and 104.1 on your FM dial, Greater Portland Community Radio. This program is on the air thanks to our listeners and a grant from Independence Biofuel, providers of earth-friendly alternative fuel made from renewable agricultural sources, biodiesel for vehicles, bioheat for homes and businesses. Independence Biofuel can be reached at 1-800-228-1883 or at www.biofuelme.com. So.
That was a very happy break.
That's right.
Was that a happy break? Did you guys have fun in there?
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. Good times. So, apparently if you use this, I can't say that. We have to provide zero value for our underwriters. It just had to deal with turbines and hydroelectric power.
Oh, yeah.
And soybean-based gasoline.
Oh, yeah. Although you got to be careful about the genetically modified...
the GMO biodiesel.
It is a problem. I actually have been burning B100 biodiesel in my tractor for quite a few years in the summer. And it's you don't get headaches like you get with the diesel. It's a wonderful thing. And I burn it in my furnace at home, too. But there is the GMO side of it.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you can turn something good into something evil.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, leave it to Monsanto.
But at least you can get some GMO-free soybeans out there. You get 400% more yield from rapeseed or canola than you get soy, and it grows better in our area. But if you've ever talked to Percy Schmeiser or heard about him from Canada, it's virtually impossible to get untainted rapeseed.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Also, thanks to Monsanto.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, we should do a whole show on those. Well, I was going to say a bad word that I'm not supposed to say on air, but everybody knows what I'm going to say.
We have an opening next month.
Oh, we do.
Yeah. You think, like, soybean crossbred with scorpions would make excellent fuel?
I'm thinking politicians and regulators.
PMO, no. Sounds good to me. Thanks, Bill. And you are tuned in here to Sound Ecology every Wednesday night at 7:30. This is a show in Greater Portland Community Radio where we don't kowtow to any corporation. So we're not beholden to no one here. So we speak our minds. In the studios with me tonight, and again, we're talking about eels and the damage that dams are causing to the eel population. So in the studio with me tonight is Ed Friedman. Again, he is the chair of Friends of Merrymeeting Bay. So we're really glad to have you here, Ed. It's a pleasure to be talking about these really interesting creatures. No, it's true. The more I'm learning about it, I'm starting to become enamored with Elvira here. And also in the studio is Kathleen McGee. She is a former board member for Friends of Merrymeeting Bay and also an environmental activist. She's just been active doing a lot of stuff in the state. We're glad to have you here, Kathleen.
No moss growing on her.
Absolutely, not a bit. So I think where we kind of left off with the eels was that we were talking about the issues around toxins and how that also contributes to the population. So I want to kind of wrap up that. We've got about 20 minutes left in the show, and we have a lot of ground to cover.
Yep.
Or sea, as the case may be.
I should say, first of all, the eels tend to live on the bottom. So in areas where all kinds of stuff settles, I think highest level of PCBs may be found in any living critter may have been from an eel in Boston Harbor. I've heard something like that. So they live on the bottom, and then a lot of our most important toxins, the dioxins, PCBs, things like that, the organochlorines or persistent organic pollutants, tend to
accumulate
in fatty tissue, and eels have a lot of fat in them. So combination of living on the bottom, eating a lot of stuff that settles down to the bottom, being, when they get old, kind of at the top of their relative food chain. No one really messes with the eels, you know. And accumulating, in this case, maybe 20, 30, 40 years of toxins. That's where they're bioaccumulating. They can be pretty potent. So, you know, we talked about dams briefly, about how those impact in a negative way the eels and their migrating. Other things may play a role in dwindling population as well. Could be some overfishing going on. Could be some change in ocean currents, ocean temperatures. Could be toxins. But we don't really have any good documentation of any of those things. Fishing maybe. But the other thing to know, we have great documentation of eel mortality due to dams.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying, and so the dams and the toxins come together when an eel migrates out or attempts to and is mutilated by the dam. We've got a case of long sequestered toxins inside of an eel, depending on the river it's in, and we know this because we, the Friends of Merrymeeting Bay, actually sent out 5 eels that were killed by the dam at Benton Falls on the Sebastopol River, a tributary of the Kennebec, out to Texas A&M for chemical analysis, and they came back really hot with PCBs, levels in the range of 500 parts per billion or so on average. Now, the state toxicologist issues a fish consumption advisory when levels in fish get to be about 11 parts per billion. So we don't know for sure how those toxins affect the eel's reproductive cycle, but we do know that when an eel gets mutilated and it shows up on the gravel bar, we've watched bald eagles eat the eels.
Mm.
And we know that fish are eating the pieces, and otters and mink and other piscivores or fish-eating species. So we're reintroducing those toxins right back into a relatively
at
local
an extraordinarily high level.
Yeah, well, and also to species that already tend to often be at the top of the food chain, that are most prone to issues from excessive contamination.
780-4909, 780-4909 is our number here in the studio. We've got about 17 minutes left, and so there is plenty of time for phone calls. So how do we know about the numbers, the population of eels? And how do we determine that, in fact, I mean, we know that they're here, and they never get a chance to get back to the Sargasso Sea to breed. So we know basically how many we're destroying, but how do we really know what the population?
Hard to know. It's based really just on some sampling as elvers try and come up and go around dams in the spring. Catch records over the years along the eastern seaboard. Some states have kept better records than others, and we've generally seen a decline. Excuse me, I should say that probably one reason why we're becoming more aware of this now and seeing these declines are that, at least I believe, that over the years, we've had dams on our rivers for years, but they've been tightened up a lot in the last 20 years, maybe 30, mostly 20. A lot of the dams used to be stone, used to be crib work, wood and stone, fairly porous, pretty easy for a little elver to get through, to get to the upper reaches. People started to concrete over the dam faces the last 20 to 25 years, and so much harder obstacles to surmount for eels. So we may be seeing the gradual bleed off now in terms of adult eels, of eels that made it up, you know, a long time ago. And we have a 20-year lag, 15-year lag, 30-year lag, whatever. So this may just be becoming more obvious right now. Like with the sturgeon in the Kennebec, when the Edwards Dam went up back in the early 1800s, sturgeon had about a 17 years before they're sexually mature. It was 15 or 17 years after Edwards Dam went up, and it had blocked off 18 miles of prime habitat, that the sturgeon commercial catch, just dropped in half. So there's a time lag sometimes in when we can recognize the impact of something that we're doing and the negative impact that it has.
Well, you know, I find it really interesting because, you know, you talked about trying to put them on the endangered species list, which would seem to make sense. But at the same time, you know, you start thinking about that, and if they do make it onto the endangered species list, this will impact the dam owners. And we're talking about hydroelectric dams. These are dams that create electricity. And energy. So we're talking about economics here. So let's, you know, I'd like to take a look at, you know, what are the hydroelectric dams owners saying about this, and what are they trying to do to help or not help in this case?
Well, I should say one of our models is eels and electricity. It's not payroll versus pickerel. It's eels and electricity.
Well, I think that there are a couple of things with that. First of all, you know, you have the powerhouse of Florida Power and Light, International Paper, who are not hurting for capital. And the bottom line is that it's costing them more to fight this than it would to fix this, and that's pretty standard. And they're getting the help of the DEP and possibly now the BEP to continue to just fight this. Eels, again, they're not sexy, so, and they're not as much of an economic impact as, I mean, we don't have sports fishermen worrying about them, although they should, because they're good feed for various different species that we do, those guys do care about. But the bottom line is that those guys will
those
do what they,
those guys those, you were out smelting last week.
No, I'm talking about the hydropower plants.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I thought you were talking about the sportsmen.
The hydropower folks kind of do what they always do. A lot of these corporate kind of folks do, which is they're going to squash anything environmentally active because any any foot through the door is to them, you know, just, it's not so much a matter of death for them, it's a matter of arrogance. They just won't allow it to happen. So the silliness of it, we went to a BEP hearing and there were so many suits in that room, all saying, you know, it's going to be the death of hydroelectricity as we know it, which, you know, may not be the worst thing in the world, but it's also not true. So the hundreds and hundreds of dollars an hour that we saw there to say, you can't even have a hearing about this, was really kind of told the story. And the DEP is supporting them. They're very good friends, all of them. The BEP bought that on the Androscoggin. They did not allow us to go ahead with a hearing on the Androscoggin, just to talk about how we can have passage. Just passage. We're not saying we need to shut down the dams. We're not saying that.
Well, that was my question. Isn't there some way to make it safe for the eels to get through? And what are the costs associated with that?
Yeah, and they need a deep gate. They need to be able to just get through where there aren't turbines. Or they need to shut down the turbines at night for a few months, which really, economically, is really not all that horrible.
Wait, I love the comment. Won't little old ladies in Maine freeze?
Yeah, well, these guys say, well, you know, it's just, you know, electricity. It's, you know, everybody needs electricity. You know, you're going to live in the dark, and little old ladies could freeze in their homes. It's Maine, you know, that could happen. But these hydro plants are sending their electricity out of state. That little old ladies aren't getting this electricity. So it's really a ruse. And they've also had huge profits, huge profits in the last few years. So it's really a red herring, so to speak, or a silver eel. It's really a matter of, there's just a significant amount of arrogance around this. And nobody's going to fight for these guys. I mean, here she is, Elvira, and we're having to speak for those who can't speak for themselves. And they know that they're not going to probably have, you know, koala-hugging, dolphin-loving people coming and saying, hey, man, you know, these are...
We really care about these.
Yes, we really care about these long, not especially attractive. Actually, this is a beautiful animal, I think. But most people are creeped out by them. So they know they're pretty safe, I think, that they can say no. We don't need to do that.
But we've talked to a lot of people, and including up in the legislature, and virtually everyone, even people who think, you know, or feel a little bit squeamish about this, understand that this is wrong and that the DEP should be doing their job, which they're not. There are at least four areas in the law that where the law dictates that these animals should be, you know, should not be killed by dams. And there are a couple of dams in Maine that have provided safe passage. One is on the Cabessy Stream in Gardner, the Ridgewood Hydro Facility there, and Damariscotta Mills is the other. Damariscotta Mills shuts the turbine down at night for passage, and you talked about cost. The Cabessy Dam there acted only after massive slaughter was brought to the public's eye there. The new manager there, Lewis Loon, went and he had a piece of plate made up with round holes in it, called a punch plate. Put that over the intake, over his trash rack, which is, of course, great to keep trees out of your turbine. Covered it over with the punch plate. And he had a deep gate already in the dam. $2,500. And no more eels are getting killed.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And yet they're paying...
They had that much in the room probably for an hour.
Well, I was going to say attorneys involved and all sorts of paperwork and time. And
not to mention, this is, I think, is important too, our tax dollars through the DEP and the BEP and the support staff and the AG's office all fighting us on this. Add that amount of money to what it's costing us to just do something as simple as that. And they are actively working against it. This is going to shock you, but they are they're not telling us the truth.
Oh my God.
they're not doing their damn job.
You're kidding. Very good.
Talk about slipping characters.
It's shocking, and in spite of the whole thing with Dawn Gallagher resigning, which, you know, she was just doing what she was told, aside from that and the fact that all the bad PR they've had and some of their department heads have done very poorly, they still have the arrogance to just act as if none of this was of any significance whatsoever. And they're just waiting to get busted all over again for this stuff because they're really not telling the truth. And I don't want to say they're lying. Yeah, I do.
Go right ahead.
And some of their staff, and it's the same in many of the departments within the age of the DEP, are so closely aligned with the industry. This is also not shocking to anybody. But when you sit in a room with Dana Murch and Andrew Fisk and all these people at the DEP and their new guy, Dave Lytle, who's 9 years at Pierce Atwood as a lobbyist, as an attorney there, is now the head of the DEP. And I don't know if people know who Pierce Atwood is, but they are the main lobbyist for the main bad guys at the State House. So he, 8, 9 years at Pierce Atwood, is now the commissioner at the DEP. Not a bad guy, he's a nice enough guy, but you have to kind of question, you know, the wisdom of that, unless what you really want is to make sure that industry is taken care of. And let's be clear about that. We've had two now, this will be the third, and he hasn't said it, but he probably will. The DEP isn't there to enforce. They are there to help business do better. That's a quote from Don Gallagher and also the one before, Kirkpatrick.
Department of Economic Protection.
And so we've had to go to the Board of Environmental Protection is kind of the public overseer, supposedly public overseer of the DEP. You can go to them for redress. You can say, please, the DEP isn't doing anything, so would you please give us a hearing so we can prove to you this needs to be done.
So the BEP is that national?
It's a citizen board.
No, it's a citizen board here in Maine.
Oh, okay, all right. I was confused by that. I'm not anymore.
Yeah.
And so they sort of oversee the Department of Environmental Protection.
Yeah, kind of. Yep. It's really the other way around. I mean, really, the DEP tells them what to do in many, many circumstances, and the BEP says fine. I mean, they basically share staff. They share an AG, Attorney General. It's very incestual.
Well, it's like a planning board in that the planning board looks to a codes enforcement officer for guidance often. So the DEP staffs, you know, The DEP wrote the findings of fact in response to our petition to provide safe passage. Mm. They wrote that as a draft that the BEP then issues. The DEP wrote that draft several weeks before they ever heard our arguments at the preliminary hearing.
See, you have to just to try to make this maybe make it less confusing. You go to the BEP and say, we would like to have a hearing where we can give you all the evidence that that we have so we can ask you to provide safe passage. Their job the first time you go to see them is to say, yeah, we think there's enough evidence here to move ahead on an adjudicated hearing. We couldn't even get that far. The DEP said they don't have any evidence. There's not enough evidence.
Dismissed them without a hearing.
So you didn't even get to. Did you get to even present evidence?
Well, we did to the BEP at the preliminary hearing. But the DEP said before we ever even had a chance to do that, don't even hear it. This is not even worth your time. And 25 pages worth of them telling the BEP why there was no much of it contradictory, and along with that, at that very, very same time, our Attorney General was preparing their oral arguments for the Supreme Court on an issue very similar to this, which is we have the right and the authority to enforce the Clean Water Act and other environmental laws here in Maine. It does not belong at the federal level. We have a right to at least enforce some of it. At the same time that that's happening in Washington, the DEP and Dana Murch and these folks are saying, we don't have that authority. We don't want that authority.
No, the Assistant Attorney General.
And the DEP both. Yeah. But the Assistant Attorney General is saying, no, you can't do that. We don't have the authority. There's nowhere where we have the authority to do that. So this is within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of each other.
Washington and Augusta arguing basically the opposite things. I mentioned Gulf Island Pond, Deer Rips Dam up at, on the Androscoggin recently was up for relicensing. Conservation Law Foundation wanted to make sure provisions for eels were included, wanted to make sure there were reopener clauses. I know we're running out of time. The DEP said, don't need to worry about eels, not an issue. Don't worry about the reopeners. We can reopen the license at any time we want. At our hearing in Augusta, when we asked them to modify an existing license, they then told us, no, we can't do that. There's no reopener clause. So this is the story of avoiding responsibility, of nobody wanting to enforce the existing laws, and giving the citizens of Maine the runaround.
And I don't. I mean.
And the governor could stop this with a phone call. Probably.
Another argument the DEP used was that you don't necessarily. We know that the eels are up there. We know that they're up in Rangeley Lake, and we know that they're up there. So we don't really need. Proof, you know, that because
if they're up, they'll have to get down.
They have to get down. Some we know that at the preliminary hearing at the BEP, Dana Merch sat at that table and said, "Well, you don't. Do you have any bodies from these dams? Do you have any other bodies? You just have them from one or two. You know, you have no proof that they're being killed." So it's the same exact thing. They're saying one thing in one venue, which is we know the eels are up there. Everybody
and
knows they have to go through that to get
and
the
admit that, yeah.
So and then straight-faced saying to the board, Environmental Protection, they don't have any proof.
It's just amazing. Well, we are right at the end of the show, and this always happens. We always run out of time just when things start getting really interesting. With just a couple of minutes left in the show, very quickly, if folks want to get in touch with you and get more information, how can they do that?
Okay, Ed Friedman, they can call me if they want at home, 666-3372. We have a Friends of Miami Bay website that has gobs of information on this, and the web page address is www.friendsofmerrymeetingbay.org. You go there, you'll see a link to the Merrymeeting Bay Cyberary, as an electronic library. That's where all of our researchy, sciencey stuff is. You'll find eels there. As you scroll down, there's also a legal documents section. And so lots of information there. And contact information for me is on the website somewhere as well.
And in about 30 seconds, what's coming up? What's the next thing you're going to be working on?
The DEP has two lawsuits right now, one of them dealing with the eels that was filed by our colleague Doug Watts on the rejection of our last petition on arbitrary and capricious grounds. And we'll be resubmitting a petition to the board signed by a lot of individuals as opposed to just Friends of Miami Bay and Doug Watts. And we have a lot of legislators signed on, and it's going to be hard to ignore that. So we're going to repetition a more complete petition, maybe a little bit better researched, and using the DEP's own findings of fact against them.
And you'll keep us informed so we can pass that along to our listeners.
We will do that.
Ed Friedman, Kathleen McGee, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Be with us next week. Yes, what are we talking about next week?
Thank you, Karen, for having us.
Oh, you are quite welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here along with Elvira, American Eel. Join us next week. We've got John Andrews and Bob Boker coming from the Eastern Trail, and we'll find out what's going on with that and why is it going through Scarborough and how much longer is it going to take to complete. Week after that, Leo Talrico is going to join us. We're going to be talking, we'll have a little bit of fun then. We'll be talking about astrology. So I want to thank everybody for listening. Stay tuned for Pass the Jug with the Old Fart. Why is it, no matter how old you are, the word fart still makes you laugh? Thanks for listening. Join us next week. Check out our website, soundecology.org, and good night to Zach.
The nation, take over television and radio station, bomb, bomb. The truth shall come, give the corporations a complication, bomb, bomb.